Department of Revenue, who will give us a quick overview. And I've asked him to comment a little bit on the history, the recent history over the last couple of years of what's happened with legislative action so that we can all understand where we begin this morning before we take up any bills. So I think Mr. Hagan's having some technical issues, but there is a presentation in your packets for today that we can work off of. And so, Mr. Hagan, I hope you'll introduce yourself for the record for the committee, and welcome. We're happy to have you here and your expertise this morning. Thank you.
Good morning, Senator. Thank you for the opportunity to be here before you today. My name is John Hagan. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And Madam Chair mentioned, I'm going to try to recap some of the history of Green Acres and where we've been and where we are and some of the process and the journey we've all been on through this. So, again, thank you so much for this opportunity. My best slide is my first slide, and it's not including your packet, so if I don't get it, I'm in trouble. But hopefully it'll be here in a second. Okay. Thank you again. As I mentioned, I'm here to talk about Green Acres, and as you all know, that once upon a time, a bill was quietly passed, which affected some farm properties. It was tucked away in an omnibus tax bill. It created a lot of confusion. It was difficult for taxpayers and tax administrators throughout the state to understand. And, of course, you know what I'm referring to is the original passage of the Green Acres Bill in 1987. That's a direct quote out of the Hatfield Commission. So something's never changed. I guess the Green Acres, by the nature of its complexity and the volume of property tax language surrounding it, has been and continues to be complex, and is many people to this day think that it hasn't been vetted properly. Well, in fact, that was the original criticism back in 1967. In 1967, the Green Acres Bill was proposed. The original bill allowed for deferred assessments if the property was 10 contiguous acres in size. It was actively and exclusively devoted to agricultural properties, and it was the homestead of the owner or contiguous to the homestead of the owner or the owner's spouse. It provided for a deferral of, in addition to the valuation deferral, it provided for a deferral of special assessments up to 3 years. And at the time of its passage in 1967, it had income requirements that required the farm income of the eligible applicants to be $750 plus $25 per tillable acre. In 1969, 2 years after the bill was first passed, there were some changes made to the bill. The first changes occurred in 1969. The homestead requirement was expanded to allow property owners who'd owned the property for seven or more continuous years to qualify. There was a prohibition to farm property that was within 20 rods of a lakeshore being precluded from enrolling in the Green Acres. The income, interestingly enough, the income requirements were amended, and they were amended downward from 1967. The $750 minimum income requirement was reduced to $300, and the acreage limit was reduced from $25 to $10 per acre. They added a provision that allowed horticultural nursery stock to qualify, and they made it clear, the legislature made clear that slough, wasteland, contiguous lands were allowed if they were under the same ownership, basically lands that were encountered within a farm property. 3 years after its original passage, there was the first extensive report on Green Acres occurred, and it was the Hatfield report that I made mention to in my opening remarks. Roland Hatfield was the Commissioner of Revenue, and he provided a report to the legislature on the Green Acres and the status of it. And in that report, Commissioner Hatfield recommended a full repeal of the Green Acres Law. He concluded that there was an unfair burden placed on the property, burden placed on the public, subsidizing the farmers, basically, when there was no major gain to the farmers. They concluded that speculators could avoid taxes with minimal farming, and the land must only meet a minimal definition of the agricultural classification. They provided a significant tax break to lands which couldn't be farmed and were sloughs, et cetera, that were just waiting for development, and it created the tax burden shift onto other properties. They concluded that the Green Acres program in 1969 did not discourage speculation, and the tax shift they were concerned would become substantial over time. In the 1970s, there were some minor changes to Green Acres. It was kind of a quiet period. They added some provisions that allowed family farm corporations to qualify for Green Acres, which was similar to changes made in the Ag Homestead provisions. Income and rental rates were introduced to the agricultural methodology with the expectation that assessors would value Green Acres lands based on income and rental provisions of the land. It's interesting to note that some years later, these provisions were withdrawn when the legislature recognized that the rental values didn't either add a good measure of farmland value or they were too erratic or too unpredictable. So after a brief attempt with using rental values to value farmland, that was repealed some years later. The second report on Green Acres was developed by the House Research Department, and they identified similar problems and inconsistencies in the program. Some of the Green Acres problems that they identified were the apparent inequity in treatment of taxpayers. Different taxpayers were treated differently from one jurisdiction to another. Law provides a tax relief for farmers, but it didn't do anything to really to stem urban sprawl. They felt that the commitment was too minimal compared to the benefit received, and they thought the statute was too broad in that it allowed hobby farms, just quasi-farms, to qualify for the Green Acres provision. And they were concerned that it extended tax relief to persons with high incomes without any means test about the need for the tax relief compared to the actual tax relief delivered. The report recommendations were that the legislature should address and clarify the purposes. They should provide tax benefits to farmers or should the property provide tax benefits to farmers or preserve land. And they determined the law could not fulfill two divergent functions of providing both tax benefits and preserving lands. In the 1980s and 1990s, it was kind of a quiet period for Green Acres. We look back on that as the good old days. The amendments made in the 1980s allowed non-contiguous properties within two townships to qualify for Green Acres, which was similar to changes in the ag classification. There was a provision that allowed nurseries to qualify if 80% of their income came from the sale of horticultural or nursery stock. And the primary test, interestingly enough, was added to the Green Acres provision. At the same time, in 1997, the primary test was removed. Prior to 1997, though, to be agricultural, there was a primary use qualification where the property had to be used primarily. In 1997, that was removed from the ag statute and inserted into the Green Acres statute, which, among other things, allowed for the split classification of certain farms, particularly in the Seven County Metro, to be split classed between residential and agricultural. In 2006, the Department of Revenue was asked by the legislature to develop a report on the status of Green Acres, and we also found some problems with the report, although ours are more guarded than some of the earlier reports. We concluded that many small farm, suburban hobby farms benefit due to the small acreage and minimal income requirements. The initial income requirements, we questioned if the income requirements were established in 1967, reduced in 1969, and almost 40 years later had not been changed, if they still served a meaningful presence. There were, interestingly enough, a few legislative attempts to increase the income requirements to make it more meaningful and more reflective of how the economy had changed from 1969 until the 2000s and the 90s. And as try as they might, legislators that attempted it had a lot of difficulty trying to find an income standard that would work equally throughout Minnesota. If it was high enough to be a meaningful test in the southern parts of the state, it was oftentimes too high in the central and way, way too high in the north. And consequently, nothing ever really got changed. We also concluded, again, as other reports had, that the purpose of the program was not clear. And we concluded that if agricultural preservation is intended, it should be specified and clarified in language. In 2008, the legislative auditor was asked to do a report, and their concerns were identified in another report that became the result of a lot of legislative changes. They concluded that the program helps to slow the rate of development, but does nothing to assure the long-term preservation of the land. They felt the program had reduced property taxes for enrolled landowners and nearby property owners, not in the program saw the tax shift. So even though it was beneficial to some property owners, there was a resulting tax shift onto other properties. The tax benefit for the program and the paying back of 3 years of deferred taxes was very small in relative to the potential gain. This is particularly true in some of the metro areas where land values at the time were as high as $150,000 per acre or more, and the tax burden from the Green Acres ag value was in the neighborhood of $4,500. So as you can see, there was a huge tax benefit that qualifying property owners reaped. The tax benefit from the program in paying back 3 years, I think I just said that. Lands not used for agricultural purposes were benefiting from the program. Again, the hobby farms, the farms that were just kind of quasi-farms because the threshold was so very, very low for some of these farms. In 2008, largely in response to the legislative auditor's report, there was a myriad of complaints that legislators were hearing from inconsistent application by various assessors. Some counties had green acres. Some counties, one county went as far as having a resolution that precluded that county from having green acres. Some counties put land, way too many lands in green acres. So there was such a mishmash of application going on throughout the state. There were all kinds of taxpayer complaints that were making their way to the legislature. At the same time, we were developing some problems, impending problems with sales ratio studies, where the easy access to the ag class, basically that if you had 10 acres of land in classes agricultural, your entire property would be classed agricultural. When it's sold, it would adversely affect the sales ratio of actual farm properties in that area. And the Department of Revenue, doing their sales ratio studies, we're in a situation where we had to keep increasing ag values, or asking assessors to increase ag values in response to the increase of these types of land sales. There, we were also, as you remember, back in 2007, 2008 period of time, there were huge double-digit inflation increases going on in land, largely driven by speculation or people's desires to have recreational land and buy recreational land. A lot of the lakeshore was no longer available. It was too highly priced or just not available. So people in Minnesota, as we all know, love to have recreational lands and love to recreate. And there was a lot of people were taking the equity in their homes and putting a second mortgage on their homes and buying recreational lands. And that market kept driving up, by double digits every year. And the corresponding problem was that the farmers had to basically compete with these same entities for the sale of these properties. So the farmland was going up very, very fast, particularly on the wooded lands, which are most highly prized by the recreational landowners. Consequently, that all these lands in northern Minnesota and probably the north half, maybe the north two-thirds of the state that had not been in green acres, it was now critical that they go into green acres if they were consistent with the law, because in most places the woodland was actually worth more than the tillable land had been. An old axiom in assessment is that the tillable land always set the upper limit of value. That was no longer true by 2008. By 2008, in most parts of the state, certainly in the north half of the state, the woodland was worth more than the tillable land. Consequently, all these properties were on the verge of going into green acres, with the resulting huge tax shifts onto residential homeowners and Main Street business people. Those threats and those problems, coupled with the legislative auditor's report, led to the major changes in the green acres legislation in 2008. And there were some major changes. Some of the primary changes were the farmlands were separated into two classes, 2A, which was land used for agricultural purposes, land in production, pasture land, tillable land, things like that, and the rural vacant land. Everything that was not being farmed was 2B rural vacant land. At that same time, there was a provision placed in law for lands that were impractical to separate, which allowed impractical to separate lands to be included within the 2A lands and included within green acres. The 2008 changes clarified that only 2A lands, the lands that were productive, qualified for the green acres class. Other lands were not allowed continued enrollment. At that time, there was also a 7-year payback that was put into law for the lands that no longer qualified. And there were some changes to the department's methodology, largely driven by the fact that assessors were expected to find what the ag land value of their property was, and in fact, it was quite impossible, particularly in the metro, and I guess you could quite generally say throughout the state, it was impossible for assessors to really know what farmland was valued at, because it all was subject to external economic characteristics, where people that were, as I said, the farmers were competing with speculators, developers, and people that just wanted to buy lands for recreational purposes. So the land values pretty much throughout the state were selling much, much higher than the actual agricultural value of the land. And backing up just a little bit, I suppose in 2008, there was, with a big change in green acres, there was a lot of changes, in a lot of confusion and misunderstanding of the changes. The Department of Revenue put out a mountain of information, and in retrospect, probably too much information. I wish we'd done a little better job managing the information and been more limited. We sent out all manner of information to assessors, how to administer the new 2008 property tax laws and the green acres laws. And we, in retrospect, I guess, when you try to look back, what some of the things that went wrong with green acres, I wish we'd been a little more judicious in how much information we'd sent out, and maybe sent it out a little more clearly and succinctly than with the massive bulletins we sent out. Part of our contribution to the all the information overload resulted in some inconsistent application by assessors and an awful lot of taxpayer misunderstanding. I think in retrospect, the seven-year clawback might have been overly aggressive. When farmers heard about this, there was an awful lot of pushback from the property owners and a lot of resentment and a lot of talk about how farmers had entered into a contract on green acres at requiring or providing for a three-year payment, and all of a sudden the laws had changed and the rules had changed, and now they had a seven-year payback. So they're very resentful from that. And removing the 2B lands from the green acres and basically not allowing it to go forward as green acres, although it made perfect sense, although it was consistent with every report that had ever been issued, the problem was it didn't really allow a landing place for the farmers who had a lot of 2B lands enrolled in green acres. And when the law changed, that land no longer qualified. So there was a lot of pushback and resentment from farmers on that. So in retrospect, as oftentimes when you look back, you do a much better job of perceiving how things should have been done. The 2009 legislation addressed a lot of those concerns and a lot of those issues. It greatly expanded the provision to separate impractical lands, and we were the department was instrumental in trying to make sure we mirrored legislative intent where the lands, if they include a ravine or a river or windbreaks, ditches, all manner of things like that, rock piles, wetlands that were encountered in a field, should not be excluded from 2A and should be included within the green acres definition. A landing place, if you like, was created in the Rural Preserve Program that allowed the 2B lands that were owned by farmers that were farm homesteads or lands that were properly enrolled in green acres had a place to land. They could go into the 2B classification, the Rural Preserve classification, and that program basically mirrored green acres. It provided for a reduced valuation of lands. It provided the same class rates and the same benefits. There were, so basically that the landing place in the Rural Preserve basically made that mirror the Green Acres program with several exceptions I'll be talking about in a minute. So just to synopsize the Green Acres program, it equalizes the tax burden on agricultural lands. Land has to be valued as market value. Market value may be higher due to the development of other pressures than agricultural value. Qualifying property owners pay tax on agricultural value, deferring the taxes due on the higher value for however long they owe the property. When it no longer qualifies, they have to pay up to 3 years of back taxes. So to benefit from green acres, you have to own the property longer than 3 acres. They have to meet basic eligibility requirements. The land has to be 10 acres of qualifying land, and it had to be the homestead of the property owner, or another provision that was added, as I mentioned earlier, if it was owned for 7 continuous uninterrupted years of ownership, it also would qualify for green acres. The Rural Preserve had many of the same components when it was enacted in 2009. The basic requirements for the program were the same. It had to have 10 acres or more of continuous acreage to qualify. As I mentioned, it had to be part of an agricultural homestead. No, actually, I didn't mention that. I was talking about green acres. There's so many changes, I'm even very confused. I apologize for that. One thing that sets the Rural Preserve apart from the green acres is that to qualify for the Rural Preserve, the land had to be properly enrolled in green acres or it had to be part of a farm homestead. The 7 years uninterrupted ownership did not qualify, which I believe is a very good thing because it stopped a lot of the migration of lands that were owned recreationally and had the low threshold necessary to qualify for farmlands of 10 acres, particularly in the north half of the state, for moving into green acres and with the resulting tax shift onto other properties. The Rural Preserve required a conservation assessment plan, and that plan got a little more, was interpreted various ways by various counties. Some counties expected more of a plan. Some county soil and water conservation districts provided plans reasonably. I know of at least one county that did not have the time or the resources to do it, and they expected their property owners, if they wanted to enroll in this program, to get a forest management plan, which was much more extensive and much more expensive as well. As a part of the program, there was a requirement that the property enrolled had to have a covenant that prohibited development of the land for a period of 8 years. The commitment through the covenant lasted for, as I mentioned, 8 years. You could, after 5 years, make application to get out of the program, and you could then get out 3 years later. At the time, your property would go to its full market value, so you'd lose the benefits of the Rural Preserve, and then I believe you couldn't get back into the program for a period of 3 years. So the rural lands are basically still the same. Some of the things that have not changed is the 10 contiguous acres used for agricultural purposes are still required for ag land. It's also still required for Green Acres. Those requirements have not changed. The primarily devoted to was added in 1997 at the same time it was taken from the Ag Homestead provisions. Only Class 2A properties now qualify for Green Acres. There were some positive results, I believe, from the changes in 2008, a number of positive results. Probably foremost among them for tax administrators was the tax treatment of land was changed to require assessors to separate the 2A productive lands from the 2B rural vacant lands. And I think as a longtime assessor and tax administrator, I would argue that assessors always probably should have been able, since property is based on an ad valorem system, what it would sell for, assessors should have always been able to separate woodlands from tillable lands and swamplands from woodlands and et cetera. Over time, as the market started to explode so much, I think a lot of buyers were not as discriminating as the assessors, and it started to sell in some areas where the woodlands would sell for one price and the tillable lands would sell for another price. And in time, the lands sort of got lumped together, which I think was another thing, looking back in retrospect, was a bad thing for some of the assessment jurisdictions that started to lump various classes of property together. So the return to the 2A, 2B separation was a very, very good thing, and it's had some real benefits in how we do sales ratio studies, too, which has prevented the assessment of seasonal or recreational lands that were sold from going into the agricultural sales ratio, which is a very good thing for keeping agricultural values more or less where they should be. The homestead class was lowered in 2008 from 0.55 to 0.50, kind of a minor thing, but a little benefit for farmers. Non-homestead class rates stayed the same, and the land programs between the Rural Preserve and Green Acres are almost identical. You've all heard a lot of horror stories about tax increases over the past few years, and that's part of what's driven a lot of the changes or the ongoing discussion on Green Acres changes. And that certainly is true. Many, if not all, farm properties saw some significant tax increases. But it was based on probably two different primary causes for two different types of property tax increases were the result of some of the horror stories. There were some lands where there were many legislators, many senators heard, I'm sure, examples of lands that increased 1%, 2%, or even 3,000% in tax, which is a huge amount of tax increase. And I would argue that all those extraordinary tax increases were the result of properties that were improperly classed and likely never should have been receiving Green Acres. Part of one of the benefits that property tax administrators saw from the 2A, 2B requirement to go out and really take a look at property was they identified some properties that were not classed properly, properties that never should have qualified for the ag class or never should have qualified for Green Acres, or other properties that maybe qualified 15 or 20 years ago that had been allowed to go back to trees, been even in some cases planted into trees. So when the assessors corrected those errors, there was huge tax consequences for the benefits they'd been receiving all these years through Green Acres, which either they were not entitled to for many, many years, or in some cases never were entitled to. The second and more common type of tax increase was the result of a culmination of the economic events that we used to refer to as a perfect storm in the Department of Revenue. As a bunch of economic issues all came together, the agricultural properties throughout the state has been quite steady, and as the residential properties have plummeted in some areas, stayed the same in other areas. Commercial values in many areas have stayed the same or fallen. The one type of property that continues to increase, largely because of commodity prices and the strong ag economy, is farmland. So if farmland has been increasing, and other types of property have been decreasing. Consequently, the tax burden has shifted more onto the lands that are increasing and off the properties that are not increasing. The limited market value was sunsetted, which I would submit to you is a very, very good thing, and I'm eternally grateful that that happened. But by the same token, because agricultural lands were increasing in value, in some instances they still had a limited market value. A lot of properties, the limited market value had gone off them, so it was no longer an issue. And that coupled with the fact that the state was making cuts in aids to some of the counties, the levies were increasing. As property values went down, they had to increase levies oftentimes to maintain the same level of services to the jurisdictions. And all those things came together and resulted in pretty substantial property tax increases, the perfect storm for tax burdens on farm properties. So what happens now? The department, where we are right now, the department will continue monitoring rural land issues and programs. Legislature has asked us to review our agricultural methodology on an ongoing basis, and we're very welcome for that guidance, and we are certainly undertaking that in conversations with the University of Minnesota and most anyone else we can find who's knowledgeable in the area of valuation of agricultural lands. We have the assessors to their credit, and they deserve a great deal of credit for coming through this, and we are working real closely with the counties to make sure that assessment practices are consistent from one county to another, and I think we've made huge inroads, partly from our efforts, largely from the efforts of the assessors, for which I'm very grateful. There were a number of changes of the result of inconsistency that were now corrected. And we continue to try to educate the public and the assessors. The assessors, I think, are, for the most part, well-educated. It's much, much harder to educate the public because there's so much information and so much misinformation that's gone out. And once a bell is rung, it's very, very hard to retract it. It's resulted in a great deal of misconceptions and misunderstandings on the part of property owners on what has happened as a result of the Green Acres Law changes. There was a common misconception is that the tax on 2B lands is higher than on 2A lands. It's simply not true. They have the same class rate. They're eligible for similar programs. And they typically, if not always, have a lower value than the 2A lands. There's a misconception that all unused land, I hear oftentimes people talk about windrows and ditches being excluded from Green Acres. That's not true either. The windrows, the impractical separate land should always be included within the Green Acres classification. Finally, in concluding, the legislative changes to rural lands and Green Acres seem numerous in nature, and in some cases they have been, but the agricultural land is still agricultural land. Agricultural land has a lower class rate than any other type of property. The Green Acres still provides the same benefits. We have to change our mindsets a little bit to recognize that the 2A lands and the 2B lands are two different entities, and there are different landing places for them. Green Acres is a great place for 2A lands that qualify, and the rural preserve provides an excellent tax benefit for persons with rural vacant land that cannot be part of Green Acres. There have been a number of tax increases and tax consequences that have been driven by values, levies, markets, the special programs, et cetera. But all in all, we are not in too bad a place. I'm particularly encouraged with some of the legislation that the legislation Senator Miller is going to propose today that makes the rural preserve a lot more palatable and a lot more simple for property owners to understand. And I think we're right now in a very, very good place going forward. And I'm very hopeful that with the adoption and passage of the proposals like Senate File 222 that we can go forward into the future and never talk about Green Acres again for a very long time, which is my greatest wish in life these days. Thank you so much, and I would stand for questions.
Mr. Hagan, thank you. We're hoping that we can relieve some of the pain for many Minnesotans on this issue, not least of which are members of this committee who have heard a lot about Green Acres. I have a question for you, however, and before I forget, let the record reflect that we do have a quorum present in the committee. But my question is, why do we have, if 2A and 2B lands get the same class rate, what is the real purpose in separating them?
Madam Chair, I believe it is critical in my mind to separate them because, as of course you know, the taxation and valuation in Minnesota is based on the ad valorem, the value of the property. Typically, ag lands are 2A productive lands sell differently than the 2B non-productive lands. The world turned upside down for a little while in the 90s, in the early 2000s, when the value of 2B lands or the rural vacant lands exceeded the value of the 2A lands. But I think it's critical to have them separate and have the assessors be able to identify them so that as legislators, if you want to give benefits to the 2A lands or to the actual lands that's producing products and crops, you can certainly do that, and you can treat the 2A lands that are in production differently than the woodlands that are used for whatever their purpose. Basically, all lands that are not in production, rural lands, are now 2B, and that's such a myriad of properties between lands that are actually grown for timber, lands enrolled in SFIA, for instance, woodlands, hunting lands, recreation lands, all manner of lands, which I think as a legislature and certainly as property tax administrators, we'd like to be able to separate those two types going forward, and perhaps maybe at some point in time the future legislatures may even have a desire to change the class rates on different types of land. So that always leaves that opportunity open for the legislature by differentiating between them.
Mr. Hagan, maybe my question was a surprise, but I don't think that – it didn't convince me. We have 55 different class rates, and if you're applying the same rate to those kinds of properties, I'm not sure why it makes a difference for a property owner. Maybe they get valued at a different rate in the marketplace, but the class rate that we apply as property tax implementers is the same. That's why I'm not sure why we're going to all this trouble to differentiate 2A and 2B and all of the trouble we go to define the differences and then try and maintain consistencies across the state. I'm still struggling to understand why it's so complicated.
And Madam Chair, I probably didn't do a very good job explaining, but I do believe that it is critical we have that differentiation. The 2B land, even though it has the same class rate, it should be valued differently. And for the assessors to change the value upward or downward, depending on market conditions, on the 2A tillable or productive land and the 2B, they need to be able to differentiate between what is what. So as tillable land increases, they need to know how much tillable land there is. And as woodland increases or decreases, they need to know how much woodland there is. Another secondary factor that's a major component of the need to have 2A and 2B separated is as happened in many counties, the threshold to get into agricultural property is so very low. If you have 10 acres of land in production, 10 acres of 2A land, you could have 200-300 acres of woodlands, and the entire property would be classed as agricultural, which is what it is. The problem we had trying to do sales ratio studies is if the assessors were unable to break out the 2B lands from the 2A lands, when a property sold and it was ag homestead and they could not, or ag homestead or just ag, and the assessors were unable to demonstrate that it was not a farm because they couldn't separate the 2A and the 2B lands, it went into the agricultural sales study with the resulting consequence that recreational lands bought clearly for recreational purposes, increased in values, and we would require the counties to increase ag land values, even though in many cases it was the 2B values that was driving the ag land values. So farmers were paying a disproportionate amount of tax in the north, two-thirds of the state, because of the increase in woodland values, 2B values, and their inability to differentiate between the two.
Well, Mr. Hagan, I think I'm going to need a tutorial after class here because I'm still having a hard time. I mean, assessors are going to look at a business property and they're going to value the building and they're going to value the land. I'm not sure why they can't look at a farm and say value one portion separately than the other but apply the same class rate and why we have to distinguish them in statute. So I may ask for a separate appointment. I really do want to understand. Okay. I'm sure you have the answer. So
I'm sure I'll try to do better, and I look forward to it.
No, I'm sure you have the answer, and I'll just maybe need to hear it two or three more times before it sinks in. But I don't want to take any more committee time. I'm sure there are others that want to talk about this issue, and we have Senator Miller and Senator Vandiver coming up. So, Senator Howe.
Madam Chair. That's a Shakespeare question, to be or not to be.
Nice.
But
nice.
too early.
Okay. John, I've got a question for you Mr. Hagan. I've got a question for you on CRP land. I've got a couple questions here. One is, you know, there's no distinction between CRP or CREP. You know, one's farmland that can come back into production, and one is a perpetual easement. And I think there should be a differentiation of those classifications, or maybe a separate classification for CREP land, or land that's into a permanent conservation easement. But if somebody has land that's in a rural preserve, are they also eligible for sustainable forest credits then too, or other payment deals? If you're getting a benefit on one side, do you also get a compounding benefit on the other side?
Mr. Hagan.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, that's an excellent question, one we just broached yesterday for the first time, ironically enough. There is a prohibition between being enrolled in Green Acres and SFIA. You cannot do that. But it just occurred to us in a meeting yesterday that there is no similar prohibition for being in Rural Preserve and SFIA, and we likely will be approaching the legislature to make such a prohibition in future years. We did conclude it's not impossible to be in both programs, and certainly it would not seem to mirror legislative intent to do
for
that.
Today.
So that's an excellent question.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
And any thought, you know, we're dealing with a forestry, a treed land issue here, but what about the agricultural land that is in a CRP and also in the CREP? I mean, there's certainly some disparities there in land that is put into a permanent conservation easement and has been affected by the agricultural land and the sales of CRP lands, and it's lumped in the same.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Howell, I've had to be very honest with you. We've had a lot of trouble trying to figure out what to do with the perpetual easements and conservation easements of CRP and RIM lands, and how the perpetual easements should be handled compared to the temporary easements. We pretty much determined that temporary easements, the 15-year or the short-term easements, should not affect a property's value. The perpetual easements definitely would affect a property's value. And how much is a matter, it's very, very hard to determine, and we've been really unsuccessful in giving too much guidance to assessors in the absence of market data. I think that's starting to come in now, where there's starting to be more market data, and it is demonstrated in some areas it is selling for less than the tillable lands, or even the woodlands, because of the restrictions on the property. But we're watching it. We have a provision now on our certificates of real estate value. Whenever a property is sold, it has to identify if it's in a perpetual easement program or not. And consequently, we're doing a better job of getting our arms around what the actual valuation of these properties are worth. And once we get some determinations, we'll be issuing better and further guidance to assessors.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Thank you.
If there are no other questions, hopefully Senator Miller can come forward and present his bill, Senate File 222. And Senator Miller, welcome to the committee. We will be kind, because it's not easy to be in the tax committee for the first time. But I did ask Senator Scoy to queue up his hardest questions for you, so we'll save Senator Scoy for last. Senator Miller, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you to the Department of Revenue and Mr. Hagan for that thorough overview. I'm going to just concentrate on the main points for Senate File 222, and then I know we have a lot of folks, a lot of other testifiers here, many of whom drove a long way, so we'll let them come up and speak as well. Senate File 222 is a Green Acres reform bill that focuses on the Rural Preserve Program. This bill reduces the requirements for the Rural Preserve Program, the category of land that is classified as non-productive or 2B land. What we're doing is we're eliminating the requirement for a conservation plan and an 8-year covenant. As land classified as productive or 2A, back taxes will remain due when the property is withdrawn from the program. Taxes are equal to 3 years of the difference between taxes based on market value and taxes based on the Rural Preserve Program. Senate File 222 will make it easier for farmers to receive the tax break meant to preserve agriculture land and protect farmers from rising property taxes due to nearby commercial or residential development. This bill is the result of multiple meetings with farmers, landowners, townships, county assessors, the Department of Revenue, Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, fellow legislators, but perhaps most importantly, the people who were directly affected by this issue. And I want to thank especially, Madam Chair, your guidance on this. I approached you on this issue, I think, the first week of session, so thank you for your guidance. And I especially want to thank Senator Scoy. We've been working together on this issue for the past several weeks, and his input has been very key in coming to where we are today. The Rural Preserve Program has been a source of frustration, confusion, and inconsistency since its introduction in 2009. This bipartisan solution recognizes that farmland is farmland, and there is no non-productive land on a farm. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know we have a couple amendments. I'm not sure if this is the right time to offer those amendments, and then we also have some other testifiers as well.
Senator Miller, we don't have the amendments yet. Now, I know you have an author's amendment. Is that correct?
Senator Scoy has an amendment.
Senator Scoy, do you have one ready to go?
Madam Chair, yes, I have the A1 amendment, and if you want, we could pass that out.
I think that's a good idea, Senator Scoy. Thank you. Senator Scoy, while they're handing that out, do you want to just briefly describe what your amendment does?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And as Senator Miller and I and others have been working through this change to the Rural Preserve Program primarily, one of the issues that came up as the Rural Preserve was implemented was a lot of inconsistency and confusion with regard to the application process and that it was called a conservation plan. We had extremely differing approaches depending upon the jurisdiction was implementing this. And so what the A1 amendment does is it clarifies that the application must include an aerial photograph or a satellite image, and that clearly delineates the type of land that's included in the application, and so that when the application is filed, there will be some record of what was there at the application time to ensure that it stays as a qualifying parcel. But I would offer the A1 amendment. I've talked to Senator Miller about it. I believe he's supportive of it and would ask for the committee's support.
Senator Skoy, do you know if all of the county assessor's offices that would be doing this would have the ability to provide these photographs so we're not actually putting the burden on the property owner to get an aerial photograph?
Madam Chair and members, I don't know who handed these out, but handed out today were the aerial photos that all the county FSA offices would have. Now, if for some reason there isn't an FSA office, a Farm Service Agency office within the jurisdiction you are, you could always go on to Google Earth. I mean, it covers the entire state. You can zoom in and get a photo that would be completely, applicable to this. So I don't think getting an aerial photo to put with the application is an issue, but all the FSA offices have this type of aerial photo for all the farmland.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Skoy, what's the frequency of these aerial photos being changed from year to year?
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, I think FSA flies every year.
Senator Limmer.
There's actually a government agency that takes pictures of land every year. It's like a nonstop business then?
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I'm not going to speak to FSA, but I think they do it to ensure that what is being done, said was being grown on the land, is actually being grown on the land. But I believe FSA flies every year. Maybe one of the farm organizations can correct me if I'm wrong. I think they fly every year.
Is there someone here who can testify to that point? Otherwise,
Madam Chair, the reason I raise the question is if there's an application process that is referred to in this amendment, how long would it take to get a clear delineation by the most recent photograph in order to process this? Or does the applicant have to wait a year? Or I knew DNR used to take photos of land, but I thought that was a greater frequency, like once every 10 years. Or perhaps they shift sometime, and I don't know if it's not every year, then are we forcing a landowner to wait for a long period of time before they can make any changes in their classification?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, remember this is for the rural preserve, which is for non-cultivated lands. So it's supposed to be lands that are green of some kind. And I think what the department has been trying to do in their implementation of the rural preserve is to make the case that if it's green, it should stay green. And I would believe that that would indicate that it would have been green over a number of years. But I really don't think this is an issue, but if somebody thinks we've got to add the words, you know, when available or something, I don't see that as a major impediment. But for those of us that are farmers, we work with these photos all the time, every year, as part of the certification of your crop process.
Sir, you look like you have an answer. Can you introduce yourself for the record and to the members?
Chris Raddatz, Director of Public Policy for Farm Bureau. I'm not an expert, and I don't have the definite answer, but I would agree with Senator Skoy that I don't think it's going to be a hardship in any means, because The farmers go into their county FSA office, and those are the same maps that are many times used for wetland determinations, and so they're widely used, and most of these properties we talk about are farms. So it's farmers that have gone into the agency, and then you're just trying to delineate that specific area that would be a Class 2B property. We certainly could contact the federal agencies and get more definite information, but we think also that they might even be using satellite photos that they are getting this information from. So we could track down more information for you.
All right. Senator Limmer, if I could suggest, maybe we can take testimony from some of these folks and you can consider whether you want to make a change or what your position might be on Senator Skoy's amendment. And in the meantime, we can hear from Mr. Raddatz and also Mr. Holmstrom, the Chisago County farmer, who's here from the Farm Bureau, who would like to speak about Senator Miller's bill. And then up we'll have Mr. Tom Peterson, Director of Government Relations, and Ron Drood, representatives of the Farmers Union. So, Mr. Raddatz, thank you for joining us today, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's a pleasure to be here today in support of Senator Miller's legislation, Senate File 222. I do believe that through a lot of hard work.
Mr. Raddatz, excuse me. Senator
Skoy.
Senator Skoy, your guest should not be at the committee table. Just a friendly reminder, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. All right. Mr. Raddatz, I'm sorry for the interruption.
No problem. We're glad to support Senator Miller's legislation, Senate File 222. And I think, just to go back, I think Mr. Hagan did a great job of, you know, the history of that, where we're at. And a lot of you have heard support for repeal of the Green Acres changes that were made in 2008. In fact, that is a position that Farm Bureau has. But as we look at that and listen to our members, I think really what our members are saying is we want things to go back like they were before 2008. And what Senator Miller has with the bill gets us back there, you know, really close to where we were, because the concern right now is with the Rural Preserve Program and the covenant and the plan requirement, and that's why landowners are reluctant to put their land in that program. In 2008, we continually asked the question on the changes being made to Green Acres, was this going to impact farmers and farmland? And the answer really is no. If you had tillable land in Green Acres before 2008, it still is in Green Acres with those changes. The issue became the 2B property and the rural preserve. So Mr. Holmstrom is going to talk, I think, about a personal example of how that rural preserve program has caused some issues. And we've handed out a copy of his statement, so I'll turn it over to him.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Holmstrom.
Thank you. My name is Glenn Holmstrom. I do farm up in Isandy and Chisago counties. I live in Isandy County. I've owned land up in both those counties. I would strongly urge you to support Senator Miller's bill to repeal that covenant and the conservation plan on this 2B land. Both in my own personal case and in talking with landowners that I rent land from, one of the biggest points they have against this 2B is the covenant and the conservation plan, in that it seems to what scares them, I guess. They don't like the idea of putting that covenant on their land. It takes away some rights that they're concerned about. In my own personal case, our home farm that was homesteaded 130 some years ago now has, out of 304 acres, it has 16 acres that are some old growth oak trees next to a lake that's on the property, that borders the property. So of the 304 acres, that 16 acres would have to go in rural preserve. If it does not go in rural preserve under the present law the way it is now, my taxes on that farm would go up, according to my assessor, by several thousand dollars, because he would have no choice but to tax me at lakeshore rates, which are taxed on a per-foot basis of lakeshore. And it's a little over a quarter mile of lakeshore. And so putting it in the rural preserve would then allow me to keep the taxes down, but it would also include this covenant. And while I don't plan on doing anything with the property, I never say never anymore. You never know what happens later on in life. So the other option I have is to remove those trees and turn it into field, and then it would qualify for 2A land. It's not something I really want to do, but it's the lesser of the two evils as I look at it.
Thank you, Mr. Holmstrom. We also have Mr. Peterson and Mr. Drune representing the Farmers Union.
For the record, my name is Ron Drude. I live in Farm in Isani County. Good morning, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
In the late 1960s, at the urging of the Isaac Walton League, I testified in favor of the original Green Acres legislation. You have to remember I was only 4 years old at the time. That's a little humor. Unfortunately, we built a new home on our farm a few years ago, and when we moved our stuff into the new house, I threw out my files, which I just really kick myself for now, so don't ever throw out files. But the point of the original Green Acres legislation, and it wasn't quiet, it wasn't a quiet time, it was front page of the St. Paul Pioneer Press and Dispatch. Farmers in Wright County, where existence was being threatened by development because they were talking about extending sewer and water services through farmland and assessing them with seven-figure assessments that these little dairy farms obviously couldn't sustain. Also, the whole idea that there were non-agricultural factors that were driving up the valuation of this land, that was explicit language in Green Acres at one point, that Green Acres values could not be impacted by non-agricultural factors. Now, you've heard a very contrasting story here today from the Department of Revenue. There, all of a sudden, various concepts of marketing factors are coming back into play, and that certainly wasn't the intent of the original legislation. The real overarching intent of the original legislation was to preserve farms. That also, I think, has been lost sight of, and that's slightly different from preserving farmland. It's the primary goal. The secondary goal certainly would be to preserve the farmland. It's the basic resource of the farm. But you can preserve farmland and tax farming out of existence. That should probably be intuitive to all of you. I got upstaged by the to be or not to be. I've used that before. I've been testifying on this matter in the 1960s and then again in the last three legislative sessions. And it's my view, and very disturbed by this, that the testimony mostly coming out of revenue, in my view, is very cherry-picked. It's very biased to the point of almost having an attitude. We've forgotten that agriculture, depending on how you measure it, is either the first or the second largest industry in the state. And this original legislation was intended as a support for agriculture. The other real issue with this down the road beyond today, I certainly support the notion of removing these constraints that are before us today. But the devil is in the details. And I passed out those aerials, that aerial photographs that you have. The top one is a section of land that our farm is in. And if you look at that mosaic of pieces of different stuff, trying to separate that out, trying to come up with values on a patchwork like that is going to be a really dicey proposition. If you flip it over and look at the other side, that happens to be the area that Mr. Representative Marquardt lives in Norman County. And the only non-planted land in that photograph is a road. There are places in Minnesota that look like that. They present nowhere near the kind of dilemma that we have where we live, so far as the separation. The other thing that I'd like you to consider long term is that rather than this term non-productive, these are non-revenue generating lands. it costs my family and every other family that owns land like this money to have them out there. We don't make a dime on them. I think that should have substantial weight in this. And they're not isolated. There's a band of land that traverses the state from the St. Croix River to the Dakota border that's roughly a third of the state in width that has a lot of land that looks like this. Not all of it, but a lot of it. There's also a really big block of land that's called the Hiawatha Valley that follows the Mississippi River southward, say, from Hastings. The Coulee Country or the Hiawatha Valley that has more land that's non-revenue producing than it does land that's planted. Somebody needs to take a very deliberate and serious look at these details to come up with a scheme of determining a value for taxation purposes. And it's going to be tough. I've worked on bodies that have promulgated rules for the state and on a statewide basis. Promulgating rules or programs is a tough deal. And
Mr. Drew,
that's why I gave you these two extreme examples.
Mr. Drew, I thank you for that. Can you just say, do you support the provisions of Senator Miller's bill?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Thank you. And
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Miller. Or Senator Limmer, excuse me. I got your – that's Limmer and Miller. That's pretty good. Okay, Senator Limmer.
It's a dyslexic thing.
It is.
Sir, my question, you know, I'm a city kid, so I don't know a whole lot about farming. But photographs like this, do you guys rely on photographs in order to make your farm policy for your actual farm operation? And do you know how the frequency of when these pictures are taken?
They've cut back on the frequency. They used to be taken every year, but with federal cutbacks, et cetera, I don't think they're taken every year at the present time. They're used more administratively, I think, than most of us that farm know this land by bouncing over it year after year after year, more infinite personally than you would from the photograph. But they do serve an administrative purpose. They are available. And they would be available to an applicant. They are no longer available to third parties because they're considered proprietary information. So those are the photo you'd get today wouldn't look exactly like that one.
Madam Chair, is this a federal agency that takes that photograph, or is it a state agency?
I'm sorry?
Is it a federal agency that takes the photos, or is it a state agency?
They used to contract the work out. They don't physically take them. They contract with vendors to FSA. Yeah.
FSA is a federal organization.
Right.
All right.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson from the Farmers Union, do you have additional comments, sir?
Sorry, I'm having real hearing difficulties this morning. Would you repeat that?
No, that was me. Madam Chair, my name is Tom Peterson. I'm the government director for the Farmers Union. And we just real briefly are also supportive of Senate File 222, which removes the covenant and the need for the assessment plan. Our members weren't comfortable with the plan or the covenant by and large. You know, one of the things we see, too, that we forget a lot of times is the average age of a farmer in Minnesota is 57. When we see the new statistics coming out, it's going to be, I think, 59. And in this area, it can be even higher in some of the heavy green acres area, which starts really in the southeast, curls up to the Twin Cities, and then goes a little north and takes a hard left to Stearns County and then up into Otter Tail County. And that's where we, you know, when you're making a decision, it got to be very difficult. One thing that I think this legislation gets us back close to is it gets us back to the idea that we hear a lot from our members is that a farm is a farm. And I think that is one thing that we appreciate Senator Miller having. And I would also add that I don't see any problem with Senator Scoy's amendment either, that farmers are pretty used to using the maps for a lot of different things. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. We have Mr. Hacken, the Winona County Assessor from the Association of Assessing Officers. And Mr. Hagan, if you would join us again so you can express the department's position on Senator Miller's legislation. And we also have Senators Magnus, Vandeveer, and me now joining the committee. So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mr. Hacken.
Thank you.
My name's Steve Hackman. I'm county assessor in Winona County. I've been there since 1997. In a previous life, I worked north of the Twin Cities in Chisago County and Pine County, and I've been dealing with green acre issues since 1978. So I think I have some background from the olden days, as we call them. In Winona County, our non-productive land or 2B land approximately is 48%. And our tillable land in the rural areas is approximately 52%. So it really strikes our farmers a lot on this, because you pretty much can't have a farm in Winona County without significant non-tillable acres on it. The biggest concern we've heard from our property owners, they weren't thrilled about the covenant. They weren't thrilled about the program that the plan they had to do. They just, you know, certainly wanted to preserve their lands and didn't have anything, but those things became an issue. At this point, even though we have all of those lands, we've had zero applications for rural preserve, and we had a lot of people take their properties out of green acres during the get-out-of-jail-free time that ended on August 16th of last year.
Mr. Hacken, can I ask you, is there a covenant for the green acres 2A properties?
No.
So then both would be parallel going forward if we adopted Senator Miller's bill.
Right. I think that's one of the things that I think we were, you know, happy to see in Senator Miller's bill. Under current law, the green acre paybacks and provisions haven't changed. There's still a three-year payback. The on rural preserve, the payback provisions were complicated. I mean, we didn't understand them, other than a property owner's trying to understand them, depending if they violated the covenant, if they sold it, if they died. They were very complicated, and I think a lot of times good policy is that we'd like the property owners to understand what they're getting into, and I think this one was very difficult for them.
Mr. Hacken. Mr. Hagan, the department's position on this bill?
Madam Chair, I'm John Hagan with the Department of Revenue. And we're very supportive of Senate File 222. I think it eliminates the problems that are perceived by many farmers with the covenant and in the conservation management plan, while at the same time it doesn't undermine the integrity of the program. As Mr. Hacken testified, the Green Acres plan does not require a covenant. It has an application process, and the property owners are bound by that application process. Under Senate File 222, property owners will be treated the same. So I think it maintains the status of the program and the benefits of the program without undermining it. So we're very supportive.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Senator Miller.
Madam Chair, members, I was just wondering if one of these gentlemen could also comment on the May 1st deadline and perhaps the importance of streamlining a bill like this and the importance of that.
Mr. Hacken.
As of right now, every year there's a May 1st deadline to apply for this program, and obviously May 1st is coming up. We have a number of farmers who did nothing, which means they're grandfathered in their green acres on their 2B lands until 2013. But I believe there's other farmers that have just been waiting to see what has happened here to make their decision whether they get in or not by the May 1st deadline. So I think to, you know, help them, I mean, passing a bill on May 3rd for this really is going to, you know, become an issue with some of our property owners.
Thank you. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Hagan, and to the assessor. Do you guys see any value in having an aerial photo on the application with this Keep It Green philosophy that we're going under?
Currently, we've required, you know, there's a requirement already in the law to have an aerial, even on the covenant, to break it out. So it really isn't any change. I think the issue to having an aerial map is then everybody's on the same page on exactly what are the areas that's going to be involved in this and what aren't. So I think it would be helpful for us to know exactly what acres and what piece of land we're talking about with farm owners.
Well, Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, if we don't add the A1 amendment, the aerial photo provision goes away. So if in order to keep it, we would have to add the A1 amendment, and you do see value.
Yes.
Mr.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy, do you want to offer the A1 amendment at this time? I'm not sure there are continuing objections. Oh, Senator Howell?
Madam Chair, I just had a suggestion for Senator Skoy. And Senator Nino just informed me that they take the photos every 3 years now. Apparently they've cut back from the every year. But I'm wondering if some language might be added to say after the word include, most recent photograph available or satellite image. And the reason to say the most recent available is, you know, I've got pictures from the 1940s of property that farmland that I've owned. So I think it'd be good to have the most recent available. And that way you have the most up-to-date. And if it's 3 years back, it's 3 years back. If it's last year, it's last year.
Senator, how about if we talk about language to amend it after Senator Scoy has offered the amendment?
Sure. Madam Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment. And if Ms. Zoff could help me with the oral amendment of inclusion most recent available photograph.
Ms. Zoff.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, and members, the amendment would be on page 1, line 2 of the amendment, delete "an" and insert "the most recent available."
I'll incorporate that.
Senator Scoy incorporates that change. Senator, how does that meet your needs here?
Could we just maybe add Farm Service Administration photograph to that language?
Senator Scoy?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Howell, the reason I wouldn't do that is I don't know if anybody at the table has ever done Google Earth.
No.
But I anticipate that there would be people that would want to use it because you can get really good photographs, and it's not done by FSA. And I think you would give the landowner the choice of using whichever one they want here.
Senator Scoy, I just want to point out that Senator Limmer is about ready to have a hearing on this if you keep going on that, on the Google Earth and the data practices issue. He's getting nervous over here, Senator Scoy.
I wasn't even thinking of that until now.
Senator Howe, do you want to make a further amendment to the amendment?
I'm just... you do it every 3 years, and then you actually have a photograph that's taken that, you know, I'm not suggesting anybody could doctor a photograph with digital technology today, but I just think it might be just a tad more credible and more standardized. And we are talking about taxing and tax dollars, I think it would be appropriate to say Farm Service Agency here.
Well, how about if we do this? I'd like us to act on, if Senator Scoy would like to offer the oral amendment from Ms. Zoff, adding the language, the most recent available photograph, and taking out an aerial. If we do that, then if Senator Howe has further changes, he can offer those. Is that acceptable, Senator Scoy?
Leave in aerial.
All right. So is that acceptable, Senator?
Yeah,
Scoy?
If we could just incorporate that, or if you want to vote on it, it's either way is fine. With
you're
me.
Okay
why
with
why don't we do that? And Senator Howe, if you'll just hold for just one moment, I'm going to have Ms. Zoff read the oral amendment again, and then we can act on that. And if you have a further amendment, you can offer it then. Ms. Zoff.
Madam Chair, members, the amendment is on page 1, line 2, delete "an" and insert "the most recent available."
All right, and Senator Scoy, are you offering that as part of your A1 amendment at this time?
Madam Chair, yes, I am offering that amendment. I think we could just incorporate that.
We can, yes.
Okay.
All right, and before we take action on the A1 amendment as adjusted, Senator Scoy?
Madam Chair, let's follow through a little bit with Senator Howe's issue. He's absolutely right in that all of these lands are ag lands. By definition, they have to be in order to qualify for this program. And that would mean that I believe there are FSA photos of all the ag land in the state. So you're probably right. We could require FSA photographs.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I'd like to have Senator Magnus just talk a little bit about this, if he could.
Senator Magnus, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Senator Scoy is right, and that's why I suggested you have the Farm Service Agency maps, because when you go in and certify your acres do everything else, they use the aerial maps that they have, and they figure out the acreage from those aerial maps. That's how they administer their program. So it just made sense to me, Senator Scoy, that you use those maps, since that's going to be what the Farm Service Agency is using anyway, and those maps are readily available and accurate, and everyone, then you would have a uniform situation. Because I believe what we're trying to do with this is make a uniform situation across the state. So that would take out any questions you would have about which maps would be down the road.
Thank you, Senator Magnus. Ms. Zoff has a suggested change to the A1 amendment that would accomplish that goal for your consideration, Senator Erskoy. Ms. Zoff.
Madam Chair, if I'm understanding, I think the intention of Senator Howe is to specify that if there's a photograph, that has to be provided by the Farm Service Agency, but you could leave the option for a satellite image that would not necessarily come from the agency, if that's what you're looking for.
What I'm looking for is
Senator
that, Madam Chair, what I'm looking for is just to put FSA right in it, so it's uniform. Right. Because you're going the problem we had with the A2 and the 2A and the 2B land is the inconsistency of what we're going to use, and I think we need to give clear direction to the department. We need to give clear direction to the assessors that it should be an FSA photograph, and they can get that at any, you know. I think that's the proper way to go, and I just asked Senator Erskoy if you'd agree with that.
Well, Ms. Zoff, would you read the suggested language, and then Senator Erskoy can...
Madam Chair, members, on page 1, line 3, after photograph, insert provided by the Farm Service Agency of the United States Department of Agriculture. And then if you intended to leave an option for a Google Earth type of satellite image, that language would follow photograph, and after or on line 3, insert A.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
I think the question could be is it maybe leave the option open if the Farm Service Agency goes to a satellite photograph, which they may go to the future, just put a – with the Farm Service Agency photograph or satellite image provided by the same agency, or I don't know if you can put the photograph and or together. You can wordsmith it for me. But I'd like the satellite image to come from the USDA office to the Farm Service Administration.
Okay.
And I'm guessing that they'll go with new technology to that, so we should kind of plan ahead. But it should come from the FSA office, regardless of whether it's a satellite image or a photograph.
If you lose it,
then we'll do it.
Yep. All right. So, Ms. Zoff, would you read the suggested changes to the first sentence on the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, members, if the intention is to require that either the photograph or the satellite image has to be provided by the Farm Service Agency, the sentence would now read, each application must include the most recent available aerial photograph or satellite image of the property provided by the Farm Service Agency of the United States Department of Agriculture. They clearly didn't. Okay.
Senator Howe?
That's perfect.
And Senator Erskoy?
Madam Chair, I'm fine with that language. I would ask the farm agencies that are here if they would take a little look around amongst their membership, because there is probably about 8 to 10% of the ag land in the state that is not certified with FSA, and we need to make sure that they have availability of FSA photographs.
Senator Erskoy, I would encourage you, if you get some information about that we need to address later, we should address it, and I know Senator Miller would be open to that. Senator Miller, with those changes, are you supportive of the A1 amendment?
I am. Madam Chair, members, I just want to make one comment. Some counties, Mr. Hacken just mentioned to me that the Winona County photos are actually, or aerial shots are actually better than what this organization provides. But at the same time, this would make it uniform. So as long as, like Senator Erskoy mentioned, as long as everyone has access to those photos, I'm okay with it.
All right. Senator Erskoy, would you renew the A1 amendment as adjusted? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Erskoy or even Mr. Hacken, I'm looking at the lines 1-4 and 1-5 and frankly trying to understand that a little bit. Where it says the application must contain, and here it goes, a statement setting forth the consequences of termination of qualification of the property. I'm not sure I quite understand what kind of answer is supposed to be put into that blank, but, you know, might, for instance, the consequences be development of rural subdivisions, or is that what you're looking for in that blank, or
Senator,
is it important for government to know what the consequences of this might be?
Senator Skoy.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, what I'm reading that, and I think the department drafted this, so maybe they could answer it, but the way I'm reading that is that if the land is withdrawn, they have to have a three-year payback. That's what I'm assuming that is, but the department can
verify
that.
Mr. Hagan.
Madam Chair, I believe what our intent was in recommending that language was that to make it clear that, yes, there is a payback upon termination or disenrollment from the property. And I think, Senator, one of our concerns, too, and I'm getting a little confused with your question. I apologize for that. But some of the language where we wanted to make sure the assessor clearly notified the property owner that if they want to have any lands not enrolled, they should make it clear at the time of application. If, for instance, they want to build a house for a child maybe 8 or 10 years out, they should not enroll that 2 or 3 acre piece of property and identify that so that they wouldn't be in a situation where they'd have to withdraw all their lands if they wanted to build a structure on it or have some nonconforming use in the foreseeable future.
Madam Chair,
Senator Senjum.
I mean, if 87 assessors can understand what that says, I'm fine with it. I'm just not sure that I understand it right now, but that's
Senator
fine.
Senator Senjum, Senator, or Ms. Zoff has a suggestion that might help clarify the clarification in the amendment. Ms. Zoff.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, if there was some confusion about who the consequences, you know, what the nature of the consequences would be, on line 4 of the amendment, after consequences, we could insert to the property owner. So it's clear that it's the recapture provision that people are concerned about.
Senator Senjum, does that address your concern?
Madam Chair, that seems to render some clarity, but I'd ask others, and particularly assessors, if it's helpful.
Mr. Hacken?
I believe I understand it. I guess the only concern that I would have, if we don't have the covenants anymore, I guess we don't see a difference why this person who wants to build a 2-acre house, they can just withdraw the 2 acres at that point without a covenant, if it's going to be like Green Acres, because in Green Acres you didn't have to ever remove the entire property out. You just, you know, if you were going to sell a piece, you just remove that piece out and do payback. And I'm sure Senator Miller's bill was trying to make rural preserve as close to Green Acres as possible, so I would think the payback provisions would be consistent.
Senator Skoy, you have a position on this clarification to the clarification. Would you like it read again? Ms. Zoff has suggested a change on line 1.4 of the amendment. Ms. Zoff, would you read it again?
Madam Chair, the change would be on line 4, after consequences, insert to the property owner.
Senator Skoy?
Madam Chair, that is clarifying language that I would be agreeable to. So if you want to incorporate that, Madam Chair.
Senator Miller?
I'm fine with it, Madam
okay.
Chair.
Senator Skoy renews his motion to adopt the A1 amendment as amended or as adjusted in this committee. Any other questions, clarifications needed on the A1 amendment and what we're voting on, members? No? All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. So we are now back to Senate File 222, and I have a very small amendment to offer the A2. And members, what the A2 amendment would do is change line 1.2, line 1, page 1, line 7, would change the word assessed to properly classified, and what that does is clarify that we would not be grandfathering in improperly classified rural preserve properties. So if they were improperly classified, they should not be given that treatment going forward. Just making sure we're not grandfathering in the ones that were not properly classified. Senator Miller, do you want to speak to the amendment?
Madam Chair, and members, I would just say that I support the amendment.
Senator Skoy, any concerns about the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, I think that's a very good amendment.
Or other members of the committee? All right. I would move the adoption of the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A2 amendment is adopted. Members, we now have Senate File 222 before us. And Senator Skoy, would you like to make a motion on Senate File 222?
Madam Chair, I would move Senate File 222 be recommended to pass, and I assume it's going to the floor.
Senator Skoy, yes. And if I could say, Senator Miller, there may be other questions or amendments here, but I really appreciate the work of both Senator Skoy and Senator Miller in bringing everyone together. I think the most important thing we can do is get everyone on board, have no surprises, and go forward with a plan that people can live with. And I think you've accomplished so much so far on this bill. Members, other amendments, questions, comments about Senate File 222? Otherwise, members, Senator Skoy moves that Senate File 222 as amended be adopted and sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment or the bill is adopted, sent to the Senate floor. And Senator Miller, thank you. Mr. Hacken and all the testifiers here today, thank you for your work on this bill.
Thank you.
Senator Vandeveer, we also have your bill up today. It is Senate File 154. And Senator Vandeveer, we've done a lot of work learning about Green Acres this morning, so we are ready to go. Senator Vandeveer, welcome to the committee. Would you like to present Senate File 154?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 154 is intended to provide an appeal process, which already exists for valuations for properties that homeowners or property owners that believe that their classification as non-green acres is wrong. Currently, the only option that they have is to go to tax court. A property owner who objects to their valuation has the option of going to the local Board of Appeals. This would provide the same option to those who don't agree with their property classification. So it's a simple bill, and it just provides that, extends that appeal process to taxpayers with regard to Green Acre classification.
Thank you, Senator Vandeveer. Questions from the committee? Otherwise, we have testifiers John Call from Washington County. Mr. Hacken will join us again, and Mr. Hagan will testify about this bill. Mr. Call, welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is John Call, and I represent Washington County. The county board has reviewed Senator Vandeveer's bill and appreciates the goal he is trying to accomplish. It would be desirable to provide an avenue for a taxpayer to appeal a green acre denial without having to appeal to the tax court and pay a filing fee. The county board strongly feels that any appeal option should go to the county board of appeal and equalization. Their reasoning is along these lines. It's very important to have a consistency, as much consistency as possible, in the application of this program, as it provides a very significant tax break and therefore impacts all other taxpayers. Washington County has always felt that if you have the responsibility, as they do, for consistent property tax valuation, they need to have the authority to deliver that and therefore be accountable for it. And that is why they embrace the idea of their entity making these determinations. The board also finds itself in concerts with efforts by the legislature to spell out more clearly the qualifications for the Green Acres program so it is easier for the county assessor and their staff members to implement the program consistently.
Thank you, Mr. Call. Mr. Hacken.
The Minnesota assessors have some concerns, and I think the concerns deal with this is a very complicated issue. One of the provisions in Green Acres deals with primary use. I think assessors understand primary use. I'm not so sure county commissioners or town boards understand primary use, and I think we sometimes would like to leave these decisions to professionals. I certainly understand the property owner's issue with filing fees, and perhaps we could come up with some other alternative, you know, perhaps a review by Commissioner Revenue staff, you know, without a fee or something like that, so we have, you know, tax professionals making these decisions.
Mr. Hacken, aren't the assessors part of the boards of equalization?
We have no voting rights. There's stories about, you know, all kinds of stuff, but as assessors, we can certainly attempt to guide our boards, but we can't force them to do anything. And, you know, we could, you know, we think it's very complicated, and that's, I think, where we're more comfortable if there was a provision that the Commissioner of Revenue or someone like that could make a, you know, assistance if the assessor didn't, you know, do what the taxpayer like.
Mr. Hacken, could for those that might not be familiar with boards of equalization, can you just let folks know who serves on the board of equalization in these review hearings?
It depends on the county. Some counties, the commissioners sit on the board. Other counties have appointed boards where they take people with real estate backgrounds or some things like that and appoint those to the board. I know my board is made up of the county board, and all the counties I've worked at have been made up of the county board. They are required to be trained, but the training tends to deal with valuation issues and, you know, not so much classification and certainly not special program issues.
Thank you. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Hacken. Are there any other examples where the board would be making what is in effect a class determination as opposed to a valuation determination? And I understand the Board of Equalization makes these valuation determinations because that's their area of expertise. But these class or special provision determinations are much more a technical, professional decision that is being made. Are there other examples where the board would make
They are able to change classifications under rule. They are not allowed to give exemptions, and there's, you know, other things that assessors only can give, you know, or else the tax court or the Commissioner of Revenue. So generally, you know, at my 30-some years of doing this, we pretty much state evaluation and maybe an issue whether it's an ag class or a residential class or a commercial or an apartment, but generally nothing as technical as whether primary use is being met for green acres.
Mr. Call, is there any concern that counties might actually adopt different approaches to this issue and then end up with that same kind of inconsistency on a statewide basis? Isn't that a fair concern about this?
Madam Chair, I think that could be a valid concern, but Washington County just has always consistently had a position. They want the responsibility and authority vested in the same place.
Senator Vanderveer?
Madam Chair, I think it's always possible. But what you're saying is that if the local elected officials can't be trusted to make that determination, I think that's what it comes down to. There is training provided, but I think there's supposed to be in your packet, and I'm not sure if it's there, but a 3-page checklist from the Department of Revenue that assessors use. And I think if you look through that, if it's there. If not, I think they're working on getting it because we had turned it in yesterday. But it is a very subjective decision that's made. It's not real objective. And I think if you look through that, do you have the checklist or is that not?
You know, Senator Vanderveer, it looks like we do have it and we will be getting it. It was not distributed.
Okay,
so my apologies from the committee that it has not been distributed yet to members. Senator Vanderveer.
Madam Chair, members, I think the issue is that we trust the local boards of appeals with regard to valuations, and I think we can trust them with regard to classifications. I've had, several incidents where we've had taxpayers declined and ordered to be taken off of green acres, and after we did some investigation and and looked into it, they were actually reversed, and it wasn't a coercive issue. It was recognized as a mistake. Unfortunately, everyone can't get their state senator to come out and look at their property and make phone calls to revenue, and very cooperative and helpful Senator Scoia at the time. So I think there needs to be something. If this isn't the answer, I'm certainly open to looking at other ones. I understand the concerns about the complicated nature of the decision regarding a classification, but on the other hand, if taxpayers don't have any appeal other than to go to court, I don't think that's exactly appropriate either. We don't do it on evaluation. I think that's extremely important. We trust them to do that, and I think we could trust them to do this.
Mr. Hagan, can you answer a question about this? Would it be precedential to have county boards of equalization discussing and making determinations on classification, or do they already do that?
I think
Mr. Hacken, do you want to answer that question?
Madam Chair, classification, I would say yes. Special programs, in 32 years, I've never had a discussion on a special program at a county board of equalization.
Mr. Hagan, are you aware of the practices in the counties? If you could join us for just a minute here.
Madam Chair, I would echo what Mr. Hacken said. I have the county boards are empowered to make changes by valuation and classification, but the programs, the special programs, the exemptions, the types of determinations that require a special knowledge and a lot of detailed knowledge, I do not believe. To the best of my recollection, I can't think of any instance where they do have that power.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to determine what would be an agricultural purpose. Is it defined by a specific crop that's being grown, corn compared to alfalfa? Or let's say the farmer wanted to leave his field to go dormant for 1 year. Would that affect the tax classification?
By agricultural, the statute's very specific on what's an agricultural product and what isn't. Dormant for a year, I would say, personally, if it's part of his farm plan or, something like that, and it's historically been and it historically will, I don't see where a one-year hiatus for a management decision would ever change how we would deal with that.
And Madam Chair, it could be any crop. It could be hay. That would qualify?
Yeah, provided that it's a product for sale. That's how the statute reads.
Okay. And Madam Chair, one other question. If let's say the farmer had never put his field in a dormancy for a year, would he have to file a letter with the county, or how would anyone know that if he wanted to now enact a new farm plan or a management plan like that?
Well, Mr. Hacking.
They don't need a management plan. I mean, it's right now. It's pretty simple. It's primarily used as the delineator that we use. And again, I can tell you from my point of view, we're not going out and looking at every field every year, seeing if so and so put in a crop or didn't crop up. I don't have the staff to do that. And we work with our property owners quite closely. And I think I just don't see where that's an issue. It's never been for me in the past.
All right.
Thank you. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I've got a question, and it maybe might go to the agency. But this bill here, would this just allow it as an option, may appeal, or would it be a requirement? Because I think currently if you go and you want to challenge either your evaluation or your classification, before you can go to tax court, you have to go to the Board of Equalization to preserve your right. You don't have to do that?
No, sir. Right.
Mr. Hacken?
No, sir.
Okay.
You can go directly. You don't have to go to any of the local meetings. You can always directly go to tax court.
Has that changed? Because there's always been this perception that if you didn't go and make that case in front of the Board of Equalization, then you I always was under the impression that you forfeited your right then for any further action, and I was wondering if Mr. Hagan could speak to that.
Mr. Hagan. Mr. Hagan, you can pull up a chair to the committee.
You don't have to kneel before.
It's not Sunday morning.
Madam Chair, Senator Hout, your question. There was a law change some time ago. There was always a differentiation between appealing to small claims division and the regular division. Property owners could always appeal directly to the regular division without going to the local and county board. But before you go to the small claims division, you did have to appeal to the local and county boards. That was removed from the law several years ago because there were so few appeals to the small claims division that they thought that might be a hindrance, that people were not aware of that. And when they got to the point of appealing to tax court, they did not understand that precondition. So that was removed to try to get more people to go to small claims. Okay. I'm not sure it worked, but that was the purpose of it.
Madam Chair, so this is just going to give somebody an option to go to the Board of Equalization. They can still take it to tax court if they choose to, correct?
Mr. Hagan?
Madam Chair, that is correct, Senator Howell.
Well, and Mr. Hacken or Mr. Hagan, the county board, or even Mr. Call, anyone, the county board of equalization can decide not to act and not to hear the case under this provision or not?
Madam Chair, I do not believe that's addressed in this provision.
Senator Vandeveer?
Madam Chair, that would probably be a very good alteration to this.
Senator Vandeveer, I think there may be some work yet to do on this bill, and I don't have an amendment prepared at this time, but I would think the committee might be interested in an amendment like that. And maybe you would prefer that we lay this bill on the table until we can work through some of these issues,
that
Senator Vandeveer?
Fine, Madam Chair.
Right.
Senator Leonard?
Just so I'm following the conversation, I don't think it's been adequately defined of how this bill would be altered to reflect just the last conversation. Is it the intent to create an opportunity for this local board of appeal and equalization to hear every case, or to have the option not to hear the case? I don't think we just said it might be a good thing to add to the bill, but I don't know what we're adding.
Senator Limmer, we're not adding anything at this point. I'm suggesting
right.
to Senator Vandeveer that he consider that as an option for this bill and that he confer with the folks that are supporting it and those that are maybe opposed, that maybe that might be one way to work out some of the differences here. Senator Vandeveer?
I think, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, that's correct. I think specifically what I understand was the proposal is that the local board have the option to not review. They'd have to act in that capacity. But
I see. Okay, that's what I wanted to know.
Senator Limmer?
Yeah.
Senator Vandeveer, would you prefer that we lay this bill on the table so that we can take it up at another time when you've given it further consideration?
Madam Chair, if that would be your preference, I would be more than happy to do that.
All right. Senator Limmer moves that Senate File 154 be laid on the table for further action when Senator Vandeveer has an opportunity to work through it. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed say no. The motion is adopted, and Senate File 154 will lay on the table.
Thank you.
Senator Vandeveer, thank you. Members, we will meet tomorrow. We will have Governor Dayton's tax provisions in his new budget tomorrow, and Mr. Mossman will be presenting those changes. And if we don't finish tomorrow, we will finish on Thursday. And without further business, this hearing is adjourned.